Beautiful.
Okay, so the just to give a shout out to appreciation to Shayna, this topic was a result of a question that Shayna gave to Rebbe Rosenthal, and she asked basically if we could give some sort of insight into what Kohelis is about, Ecclesiastes, and this week's the week, and please. Anybody who has a question, please feel free to send it to Rabbi Rosenthal. I know that that's among the type of classes, perhaps the class he likes best, is the one which is a response to a question like that. So thank you for that, Shayna, and may others follow in your footsteps. So, how do we get into Kohelis? So we get into it via Kiddush Club, which is a funny way to get into it, but as you're going to see, it's an interesting way. So, has anybody, have you, I'm sure you guys have heard of such a thing as a Kiddush club.
Yeah, we have it at my shul.
Oh, you do? Interesting. Okay. So, could you describe the Kiddush club? That was Alan, right?
Yeah. I mean, at my shul, we usually do it right after the Haftorah,
Okay.
when they're doing kind of requests for healing and the prayers for the soldiers of Israel, which kind of seems like a bad time to leave, but
Okay.
it's just a group of guys, and we go into the rabbi's office. It's usually like six or seven of us, and we just make kiddush over whiskey
Okay.
and have a little like cheese and crackers and just chat it up a little bit and then go back into for Musaf.
Interesting. Interesting. Now there's a whole spectrum of Kiddush clubs, right? And some Kiddush clubs actually do some learning in their Kiddush club as well, which is sort of interesting. But
I mean, we keep our Kiddush club fairly short. It's usually
okay.
like 15 minutes. So it's, you
Interesting. Interesting.
in and out,
Okay.
but just kind of a regroup of people who, like, if they didn't make it to Friday night service, you kind of schmooze a little bit for 15 minutes. And then, before you get to the big shul Kiddush.
Okay, so a Kiddush club is in addition to the regular Kiddush. Okay,
Rabbi,
so
my shul has a Kiddush club as well, and it's a group of men who leave during the Haftorah
Okay.
and come back, I guess you could say, all shikkered in
All
time
shikkered.
for
All shikkered.
all
Okay.
shikkered for Musaf.
Okay. So
And I
that's
guess
interesting.
under the previous rabbi, their quote unquote permission to do this was they had to sponsor the big lunch in Kiddush for Simchat Torah.
Interesting. Interesting. So
Would
there was
this
a quid
be,
pro quo. There was a
is
quid
this
pro
kind of
quo.
like equivalent to like MJE has Cafe Connect? Would that be like when people start reading the Torah, people like skip out and then there's like a little like, cakes or whatever?
Interesting. I wouldn't categorize that necessarily in the same way, though. I guess there's elements that, so there's more than one type of Kiddush club. Who was it just made that comment?
Scott.
Okay, Scott. Yeah, there's more than one type of Kiddush club. So I'm going to be talking about the more extreme kind, which Shane is talking about. I would so that's the type that we're going to be focusing in on here. And the more extreme the Kiddush club is, the more persecuted the Kiddush club gets. And typically, as Jana was describing, depending upon the how extreme the Kiddush club is, the rabbi will extract concessions from the Kiddush club, or sometimes in some shuls they're persecuted. You see, and that's the humor of the video we're going to be seeing in a second. That sense of persecution that the Kiddush club has, which may or may not be justified. In the case of a more extreme one, perhaps it is justified. Less ones, maybe it isn't justified. But without further ado, would you put on the video, Shana?
Please let me know if you don't hear the sound when I hit play.
The Kiddush Club of Mount Sinai presents How the War Was Won. All around the world, Kiddush clubs are being dismantled and destroyed. Men are being forced to stay in their seats and listen to speeches against their will. However, contrary to what some of you believe, the Kiddush Club is at the core of Jewish life. Recently unearthed footage from the end of World War II only confirms this.
Dem Feind gelungen, die Front in breiter Formation zu durchbrechen. Im Süden hat der Gegner Zossen genommen und stößt auf Stahnsdorf vor. Der Feind operiert jetzt am nördlichen Stadtrand zwischen Frohnau und Pankow. Und im Osten ist der Feind bis zur Linie Lichtenberg-Marsdorf-Karlshorst gelangt.
Mit dem Angriff Steiners wird das alles in Ordnung kommen.
Mein Führer, Steiner konnte nicht genügend Kräfte für einen Angriff massieren. Der Angriff Steiner ist nicht erfolgt.
Es bleiben im Raum Keitel, Jodl, Krebs und Burgdorf. Es war ein Befehl! Der Angriff Steiners war ein Befehl! Wer schickt sie?
Dass wir es wagen, sie mein Befehl zu übersetzen! Wie weit ist das einfach gekommen? Das Militär hat mich belogen!
Jeder hat mich belogen, sogar die SS! Die gesamte Generalität ist in 2000 Haufen niederträchtiger, treuloser Feiglinge!
Mein Führer, ich kann nicht zulassen, dass die Soldaten, die für Sie verbringen...
Ihr seid Feiglinge! Verreiter, Versager!
Mein Führer, was Sie da sagen, ist ungeheuerlich!
Die Generalität ist das Geschmolz des deutschen Volkes! Sie ist ohne Ehre! Sie nennen sich Generale, weil sie Jahre auf Militärakademien zugebracht haben, nur um zu lernen, wie man Messer und Gabel hält.
Jahrelang hat das Militär meine Aktionen nur behindert. Es hat mit jedem nur erfüllten
Widerstand in den Weg gelegt. Ich hätte gut daran getan, von Jahren alle höheren Offiziere liquidieren zu lassen, wie Stalin. Ich war nie auf einer Akademie. Und doch habe ich allein auf mich gestellt, ganz Europa erobert. Verräter! Von allem Anfang an bin ich so verraten und betrogen worden. Es wurde ein ungeheurer Verrat geübt am deutschen Volke. Aber alle diese Verräter werden bezahlen. Mit ihrem eigenen Blut werden sie bezahlen. Sie werden das saufen in ihrem eigenen Blut.
Bitte gerne. Jetzt beruhig dich doch.
Umständen zu führen. Es ist aus. Der Krieg ist verloren. Aber wenn Sie, meine Herren, glauben, dass ich deswegen Berlin verlasse, irren Sie sich gewaltig. Eher jagge ich mir eine Kugel durch den Kopf. Tun Sie, was Sie wollen.
Drink, another drink.
Okay.
Be in the cellar when it's gone.
Can you,
Drink, the glasses.
Okay.
Wow. Right. I mean, what? I know that actor, and, like, I've never seen, like, this movie, like, about, like, World War II, but, like, first, I thought it was, like, real, because it was so, like, synced perfectly.
Right. That was
a, no, he started joking. Like, I was like,
quite
okay,
a piece of work.
This is a comedy.
Quite a piece of work. Can you bring back that sheet, Shayna? So there's more to the Kiddush Club than meets the eye. More to it that meets the eye. As the movie depicts, why is this club limited to a select few tight knit group of men?
Well, I believe you have to pay to be part of the Kiddush Club.
Uh-huh. Well, obviously it's expensive to get the liquor, right? But why in the skit are the which is made by the Kiddush Club? That was actually made by the Kiddush Club of Mount Sinai in Washington Heights. How did they explain that the need for the Kiddush Club?
And it's a catharsis for the stress of the week.
That's right. They're working hard all week, and you can see where it's coming from. And they want to have a tight knit group of friends to hang out with a little bit, to recover, to enjoy life a little bit with. Which is, of course, why high-end liquor would be served as well. It's, you know, getting a little bit of the good life in the weekend. Now, depending upon on which Kiddush Club, there's different Kiddush Clubs are more or less sensitive, and therefore, interestingly enough, they're more or less accepted in the shul. Let's think of the most extreme ones that Shani was talking about. They leave during the Haftorah, right? What's that pointing to?
I mean, because they go to services more to hang out with their friends and drink and not daven.
There's a tension. We all have that tension, namely, which is why there's Kiddush altogether. Namely, there's a very important social dimension of going to shul, and all of us, to one degree or another. Shul on Shabbos particularly be pretty long, you see? So being able to cut out from part of it, there's sort of forbidden fruit of getting away with it, of escaping, you see? And that is pointing to something which is an interesting thing, namely, that there is a stress which is coming from mitzvah life, and the Kiddush Club, to a certain extent, depending of course on the Kiddush Club, is relieving that, releasing that, and therein lies a important phenomenon, namely that perhaps the shul should be thinking about Kiddush Club and everybody else. Namely, what would it take for the shul to be a enjoyable experience? That's something people should be thinking about. Namely, should it be necessary for the Kiddush Club to want to escape in that way? Might that raise a question as to how to make the shul more meaningful? There's an interesting question there that needs to be raised. Perhaps rather than giving the Kiddush Club too hard of a time, every shul should be thinking, maybe if the shul was more meaningful, there wouldn't be need for such a Kiddush Club, or the Kiddush Club could be one of the better Kiddush Clubs rather than one of the more extreme Kiddush Club. Now,
I was thinking also in my shul we also have like a professional tot time, so there's a whole children's zone set up for all of the kids to go to as well, and it's, you know, it's partially to give the parents you know, some time to focus on davening, but it's also for the rest of the community kind of a plus, because then you don't have the kids in the sanctuary and they tend to have shorter attention spans, they're making noise, they're moving around, so it's kind of a win-win whether you have kids or you don't have kids, that there's a separate activity zone for the younger crowd. And that was kind of made me think. Kind of made me think with the Haftorah Kiddush Club. It's like they're in a sense doing the other congregants a favor because they might otherwise be sitting in the pews, you know, talking or whispering.
Good point. And for good point. That are good point. Interesting point. Interesting point. Which goes to the point I wanted to say. Go ahead, please.
Just to conclude, they're kind of doing everybody a favor.
Right. Could be. Now, which goes to the point that I was going to make with Scott, it very much depends on the particular Kiddush club. For example, that, what was that space you were talking about, Scott, at MG, where people can go?
Cafe Connect. It's like right Cafe after Connect. The first Aliyah. Like,
right.
They announce and people go over and there's a little, they talk about like that week's Parsha and there's like, you know, muffins or something.
Right, right. So MG puts a tremendous amount of effort into making the shul experience meaningful for the people who are coming and providing a carefully graded amount of experience depending upon the person. So if one's going to Cafe Connect, there's still going to be some learning. There's still going to be some content, you see. But the extreme Kiddush club indicates a synagogue which there's an imbalance. There's an imbalance. And that imbalance has to be addressed. There has to be a proper proportion. Every Kiddush probably for even till the time of Yemos Mashiach will have a Kiddush. And maybe even there'll be a Kiddush club of some kind, depending upon when they leave the services. But what we don't want to have is a shul which isn't paying attention to the enjoyment of the congregants, or congregants who aren't working together with the shul to make the experience more meaningful, because then there could be a Kiddush club which is an escape. And when one is escaping, then one can't be working to make things meaningful because one's escaping, you see? And that is where we're going to get into Koheles, because Koheles was addressing that very point, namely, at what point is one's eating and drinking a escape, and at what point is it a useful and meaningful and supplement to one's enjoyment of life? Let's take a look at the Rambam, and then we'll go into the Koheles itself. Anybody? Let's try Dan Lasman.
I'm still driving, but maybe next.
Oh, so you can't read. You can't read. We don't want somebody driving reading. How about who feels up to doing a little reading?
I'll read. I'm Jade.
Okay. Jade, right? Hi, Jade.
Hi.
Would you read the Rambam's Laws of Character Traits, please?
Sure. A Torah sage should not be a glutton. Rather, he should eat food which will keep his body healthy without overeating. He should not run to fill his stomach like those who stuff themselves with food and drink until their bellies burst. They are alluded to by the statement of the prophet Malachi, "I will spread dung on your faces, the dung of your feasts." Our sages explain these are the people who eat and drink and make all their days like feast days. They say, "Eat and drink, for tomorrow we will die."
Right, that's Isaiah 22:13. Okay, so. What is the strategy of the Torah scholar in regard to his eating? Based on this Rambam.
I mean, it seems more like, you know, if we have the mentality of eat and drink and tomorrow we'll die, it's very like pagan-esque, you know, like it's not in line with kind of how we're supposed to treat ourselves and our bodies.
Who's this?
Alan.
Good point, Alan. In contrast, how does the Torah sage view his eating?
Everything in moderation.
That's right. And in other words, and what would define moderation?
Right, not to eat too much, not to eat too little, like just eat what's right for you and be conscious of it.
That's right. That's right. And ultimately, it's fuel. Our food is not our life itself. It's fuel which gives us energy to live our life.
Well, it's also so, like,
go ahead.
In the Roman days,
when they in
Rome, ancient Rome,
yes,
have these massive like food orgies and sexual promiscuity in themselves and vomitoriums.
That's right. Why? Eat and drink for tomorrow you die, because that's a mind which hasn't been privileged to be to the Cafe Connect. That's a mind which has not been privileged to be awakened to deeper things. And also, therefore, go ahead.
It's just it also, Alan again. It also
Alan.
The fact that there's no afterlife, right? You have nothing to live for.
That's right.
That's the point. But we do, as Jews, have something to live for at the end of our lives.
That's right. Namely, the food, in other words, depending upon how meaningful our lives are, how much we are enjoying our learning, that's how much recourse we will have to have to eating to distract ourselves. For example, the person who has the wonderful job, the wonderful set of friends, the wonderful life, that's not the person typically in the movies you're going to see depicting eating an entire gallon of ice cream. The person who has just lost their job, the person who has just lost their set of friends, that person is trying to compensate for it by eating that gallon of ice cream, which is eat and drink for tomorrow we die. In other words, that's the person whose loss is so great, whose meaningless is so great, that all they can possibly imagine for in their life is the eating and drinking. And of course, the Torah scholar is the antithesis of that. That's the person who is enjoying their life, who is excited about their life. Therefore, they enjoy their eating and drinking, but it helps them. It's a means to their higher pursuit, their higher life. Now, there's a whole spectrum of this. Even a person who is enjoying their life, who has an intelligent experience, could have parts which they're not paying attention to for a second. For example, number seven. When the service is over at MG, how do people react to the opening of the Kish?
Like, let the floodgates open.
Vultures.
People rush in.
Right. It's not just the MG. It's everywhere, right?
And the short people are all pushed and shoved. And no one, and oh, the PT people.
They get trampled.
PT people get trampled over the tall people trying to get the food, and no one sees us. And we're literally pushed out of the table type of a thing.
Right. And it's not like people are going to a meal after the cage either.
That's right.
Exactly.
Right, which is so surprising. Why do people have to rush and eat so much of the Kiddush when they're going to have a lunch right after?
Because it's free. Everyone loves free stuff.
Everybody loves free. And also, everybody feels stretched by the davening, which is a good thing, right? One feels like one's mind has been worked hard. One's focus has been worked hard. So there's a certain relief at being able to get a recess and have the Kiddush.
I have a question.
Nothing wrong with that. Go ahead.
So Rabbi Pinney talked about this this concept of like taking more than what you should when it came to like hotel, like shampoos and that kind of stuff.
Right.
I mean, I feel like it's a very Jewish stereotype to kind of take more than what is like, and we always talk about the food and eating and that kind of stuff. Like, where does that kind of originate from? Is it come from like Holocaust or just, you know, not having an old country and now we have plenty?
Interesting question.
Any, or is it any, part of the Depression era? Like there's still that Depression era feeling as well.
That's true. That's true. Those are I think important factors. And I think also to a certain degree, it's intrinsic to Jewish life. Why? Because to be Jewish is to always, to a certain extent, be being stretched in the way that we all feel as we're coming out of shul and we're sort of exhausted from the marathon. Let's say Yom Kippur, the most of all. One's a little bit exhausted after the marathon. It's a wonderful marathon, but it was a marathon. So Jewish life, to a certain degree, has that marathon character to it. And therefore, we're all a little bit more than perhaps other people feeling stretched and therefore looking for some sort of way to relax, to compensate for that amount of effort and work that we're putting into our Jewish lives. And of course, when we've as a people just gone through a Holocaust, that would only contribute to that. That's part of what we're stressed about, the marathon that we're going through, or the depression of American Jewry not all that long ago, or for that matter, the pandemic. I think a lot of people have gained a lot of weight during the pandemic, right? For the exact same reason. It's a sort of a marathon. It's constantly involved in it that guides one to be a little bit more involved with one's material needs than one would normally.
Rabbi, could you even say, we're talking about how Shabbos morning or Yom Kippur davening stretches us. Could you even go so far as to say just, I guess, being parts of a community of like the learner earner as modern orthodoxy, where we are trying to balance a job in a secular world and also being observant too,
that's absolutely as well. Absolutely so. Hold on 1 second, people. I'll be right back. Okay. Sorry about that. Yes, I think that's a very good point, Jane, and we are going to come back to that in a second. That the modern Orthodox community is perhaps even more in a marathon than many others, because we're trying to do so much, trying to, I guess it's kind of like what they say about the women's movement, trying to have it all for a woman living in the modern world, a modern Orthodox woman. Think how many worlds she's having to coordinate. Being a wife, being a mother, being a modern Orthodox Jew, being an American, huge. Each one of those, any one of those things for many people is all they have to do. Coordinating all of them, being a learner earner, it's a tremendous amount of things to do. And when one feels stress, it's natural to want to ease that stress with something. And therefore, I don't think anybody's going to be finding a shul that doesn't have a kiddush, and rightfully so. It all comes down to the balance. Is the dominant theme escape? Is the dominant concept dulling one's mind from having to face all of one's responsibilities, or is it a component part of enjoying life to keep a proper psychological balance? That can seem like a very subtle difference, but as we're going to see, it's a critical balance to be made, and it's critical to what Kohelis is going to be talking about. Let's look inside. Can we go down a little bit, Shana? And here we come to Kohelis. And Kohelis brings this to a very fine point. Before we go in, when do we read Kohelis typically in an Ashkenazic shul?
On Shabbat of Sukkot.
Why Sukkot? What is Sukkot?
Outside in the dirt.
True.
I was.
What do we call it? Sukkot is the time of Zman.
Joy.
Simchatenu, of our joy. Interesting. That on Sukkot, the celebration of our happiness itself, on the Shabbat of Sukkot, which is in a certain sense a certain pinnacle of the marathon, that's when we read Kohelis. Interesting. We'll come back to that in the end, why that would be. So, Shane, in honor of your question, would you read Kohelis?
The words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, said Kohelet. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What advantage does man get from all his toil that he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth endures forever.
Interesting. Okay, I'm just going to read it in Hebrew, the second pasuk. Vanity in Hebrew is hevel. Hevel havalim amar Kohelet. Hevel of hevels, does Kohelet say, which the translation says is vanity. It's not quite vanity, but... We'll see in a second what maybe a little bit of better description of that. So Rashi would let's see, let's get somebody new here who hasn't read anything. Sarah, would you mind reading Rashi?
Sure. Okay, vanity of vanity, said Kohelet. Kohelet complains about the creation of the 7 days of creation, that all is vanity of vanities.
That's right. Interesting. He's complaining. Rashi brings a focus to it. What do you mean? It's vanity? Doesn't the Torah say it's good? As we see in the bottom in Bereshit, God saw that all he had made and built was very good. It was evening, it was morning, the sixth day. So though Hashem says that the world is very good, Kohelet says it's a vanity of vanities. How can that be? Let's just first focus on what vanity is, a hevel. The term hevel comes from the word breath. Perhaps one of the most famous uses of it is, as rabbis say, the world would not exist if it were not for the breath of the children studying Torah all day. Hevel piyam shel tinokos, the breath of the mouth of children. So how does that relate to the concept of vanity or nothingness? How does like breath, right? How is that related to vanity?
Rabbi, before we go there, wouldn't man not exist if not for breath? Because Hashem created the world from dust, but created man by, like, I guess, blowing his soul into
breathing
him.
Breathing the spirit of life into him, right? Yes, yes. There's a secret there, because what makes man, the Tzelem Elohim, is not our physical side, but rather is our mind. So the breath is a secret or a metaphor, which means that that mankind, though there may have been an evolution of man's body, the Torah emphasizes there's another dimension to the human being, which cannot be explained materially. Namely, that the creation of man requires the unique and direct impact of Hashem through his wisdom on man, which cannot be explained materially. All of man's body can be explained perhaps materially, but not man's soul, not man's mind. That's a unique aspect. All the material processes that are coming, the separation of the waters, the separation of day and night, all the different material processes are material. But there's a unique and singular creation act that Hashem does to man to make him not just a body, a lifeless material body, but a human being with a soul that can know Hashem's wisdom. And that the Torah calls breathing into him the breath of life. Okay, so breath can be very, very, very significant at that secret level, at that metaphor level. But there's also breath of the body, namely breathing. How does that breath relate to vanity or nothingness? Is there something minimalistic about breath? Is its existence somehow kind of weak?
I mean, ruach? Like, it's very strong. I mean, so it's like the only thing we need.
So it seems like you're saying there's something very significant about breath. That's what Shana was saying too. We very much need it. That's true, and that's perhaps why it's described in the Torah as being that which the unique aspect of creation of man. But there's also something very. Its existence is very weak in a certain sense. Even though its impact upon us is very, very strong, there's something about it which is very weak.
It's not consistent. You have to actively breathe. So
you have to actually breathe. And
if it stops, everything stops.
And the slightest wind, it will blow it away. It's right. Like when you're breathing and you see the cloud coming out of your mouth, it's gone. It's here, it's gone, right? Its existence is very fleeting, very, very impermanent. As much as we need it, it's here and it's gone. So there's something about the world which is fleeting. It's gone. It has no real existence. There's no permanence in existence. And so what is that? That is what everybody's toiling for under the earth. What in man's toil under the earth could be defined as being fleeting, having little meaning, having little endurance?
Uh,
Can you rephrase the question?
Well, if you were looking for a certain group of people on Earth who were working extremely, extremely hard, but if you looked at what they're doing, what they're working for is not that meaningful. What sort of people would that be? Shlomo Melech seems to be identifying there's some people maybe
that
even
aren't
many
happy
people
with their jobs.
People who are unhappy with their jobs, or maybe they're working for some sort of dream in the rat race, which doesn't really have much reality to it. People working very, very hard for some sort of dream of what it is that they want to accomplish, which maybe isn't quite as realistic as they think it is.
But also, like, what are you working towards, right? Like,
that's right.
The goal is to kind of perform the 613. Like, you should be able to find mitzvot in your job, even if it doesn't accomplish something, it may help you accomplish something else.
That's true. But some people, many people who don't have mitzvot, they might be tempted to be working 24/7 for some sort of dream that they have that they're going to accomplish, which at the end of their lives, they look back and wonder, was it really worth it? That's what Carlos is referring to when he says he looks and he sees all these people toiling. He's referring to the people who don't have that meaning, what they're working for. They're not working to have a comfortable living, to do something else. Their work, they think that their work will give them their meaning. And they're working and struggling. And Carlos looks at it and says, what's the meaning of all the dreams that they have for their accomplishments? They're toiling under the sun. They're not going to be getting, it's a hevel. It's a dream, it's an illusion, which they're going to terribly much regret at the end of their lives, or maybe even the middle of their lives in the middle life crisis. So how can Shlomo contradict the closing verse of the first chapter of Genesis that the creation is good? Is it good or is it hevel? Did Hashem make a good world? Or did he make a hevel world? Who's bringing the hevel into the world?
Man.
It's the toiler who's bringing the hevel into the world. Hashem gave us a world that we can use to get what we need from it. He didn't tell us to toil 24/7 for some dream that we have for ourselves, for being a millionaire or a billionaire or whatever it is that our dream might be. The earth is good, but man, by toiling under the sun, can bring his own dreams and illusions and screen the good of the world that Hashem has given for us. Could you go down a little bit further, Shane? That's why you talk about the person who is under the earth. Oftentimes the Torah differentiates between people whose eyes are higher. They're looking for things which are higher versus people who are stuck on the earth. All they see is the material of the earth, and they don't see something beyond the material of the earth. The person who is stuck on the material of the earth, that person is going to be stuck in hevel. The person who is who sees a meaning and a significance beyond the simple materiality of the earth around him, that person is going to be able to see the good of Hashem that Hashem is giving us in the world. It all depends upon what we put into it and what we get out of it. How does Shabbat and Yom Tov help us resolve the hevel problem of Shlomo HaMelech and find the good that Hashem has put in the world and avoid the hevel that people can toil through their own toil bring into the world?
Rabbi, Just a clarifying question here.
Go, Adrian, is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
Go ahead.
Behind the suit and the picture.
Go ahead.
So the question is, the world is good, but man...
The world is good.
But man, through his aimless efforts, does man make the world bad, or is it hebel? Is it pointless because the world is already good and you should just become a Zen monk?
Right, right.
And just be a simple person and you'll find, you know, fruit, potatoes,
right,
grow, and
that's right.
It.
That's right.
Is that the interpretation? Or
that's
or
right. Man does not make the world evil, but man can make his experience of the world evil.
Got it.
Right? So the world is good. It's there, ready to help us to grow as human beings and enjoy learning about what is all around us. But through our and that's always there. But we can, through our focus and our toil and our trying to accomplish our dreams, we can experience it in a way which is hevel. And that's what Shlomo is trying to point out to us. Now, interestingly enough, that differentiation is what Shabbat and Yom Tov is all about. And that's, I think, perhaps why we say it on the Shabbat Yom Tov of Sukkot. Namely, we remind ourselves of something. It's interesting. What does Shabbat do to toil?
It gives us a break from it.
It gives us a break from it. What's implicit in that? That if Shabbat did not guide us to take a break from it, would we take a break from it?
No.
Maybe not. It would be very hard to do it. I know for myself it would be. It would be very hard to do it. So the prohibition to toil on Shabbat and Yom Tov guides us to shift ourselves away from toiling under the sun to seeking something more, seeking something above the material, a meaning beyond the dreams of the material. So Shabbat and Yom Tov resolve the hevel problem of Shlomo HaMelech. It guides us to stop our toil, look for something more, look for something else. So that, I think, is why it's on Sukkot, because as we sit in our sukkah and we learn and we think, the message of Kohelis comes to us. No amount, as much blessing as Hashem gives us materially, that is not what's going to make us happy. What's going to make us happy is how we're going to is how much we release ourselves from our dreams of hevel, and seek to use that blessing in a way which will truly help us, which will truly allow us to grow, which will truly focus us on growing as a human being and meaning, and therefore that's what'll make us happy. The letting go of the toil and allowing ourselves to enjoy and use the material blessing Hashem gives us for something higher than that. Let's work that through in a couple scenarios. Do we have time to do so? Yes, we have time for one scenario. Jennifer MG here is hosting a kiddush. What should she have in mind in shopping for this kiddush to make it one which is focused on Oneg Shabbat versus a kiddush which is destructive and embodies hevel?
Maybe not pick up the big handles of vodka and scotch.
That's right. When you got a kiddush, you've got 20 bottles of hard liquor there and a million glasses, you're pointing in the wrong direction.
And make sure you're going to have that. You're going to have a lot of alcohol. Make sure there's like good filling food. So
keep it moderate. Keep it moderate. Keep it. Make sure there's good food there as well. What else?
Hey, Rabbi Sachs, how about having a speaker, somebody give a Devar Torah?
Excellent
point. And bring the Torah into it and not just eating
That's right.
And drinking.
That's right.
And, and the Zemarod and the singing with niggas.
That's right.
And kind of, like MJE would type of.
That's
thing.
Right. Point show the way where the food and the drink can help make a mood and ease a relaxation from what from one's toil of the week, and then opening energy to use it on something else. Talking to your friend about somebody giving a Dvar Torah, enjoying discussing it. You see, having a conversation, an intelligent conversation, where you're feeling relaxed and happy, and that relaxation and happiness from the nice moderate amount of drink and eating, it gives you energy to engage in that in a way you never focused on that before. A Dvar Torah, thinking of conversation topics of conversation to bring up that everybody will be enjoying talking about, everybody will be participating in. Excellent point, right? That's a kiddush that is balancing and allow shifting you from the hevel towards meaning of conversation, towards that Dvar Torah. Excellent point. Excellent point. Okay. We ran out of time a little bit, so maybe we'll do one more. I think we have time for one more scenario. What would a job be which is a non-hevel endeavor versus a hevel-based job? And we gave examples here of hevel-based jobs like Price Waterhouse, Weil and Gottschall, Amazon, and Google, perhaps. Not for everybody, but they might be more difficult to not be non-hevel jobs. What would the difference between a hevel job and a non-hevel job be?
Working for like some sort of like nonprofit,
what?
Charity organization.
A job which perhaps gives you enough salary to make a living, but which allows you to be involved in higher things. You see, versus a job which is the opposite. It's all consuming, 24/7 on engaging in the making of money. Nice point, Scott. The non-hevel job will allow you to balance your making of money with a higher purpose. The hevel job will demand that one constantly be involved in the pursuit of more and more material gain. Finding that balance is what every one of us is supposed to do.
Rabbi Sachs. I was going to say that actually happened to me.
Go ahead, share a personal example.
Premier investment bank.
Uh-huh.
Very hard to get very, very difficult to get a job there. And, you know, that was the type of that environment. And right. And then when I left, I'm now at my current job for 10 plus Baruch Hashem years.
Right.
And then with that found time, I decided to, you know, become more religious and
right.
do Torah classes. So all
That's
that
right.
extra time
That's
that
right.
I was used to doing a job of 2.5 people and working all the time, I
That's
was using
right.
that for Torah and getting up on, you know, Saturday mornings and going for the services and doing
That's
the
right.
classes and getting very involved and using that extra time very, proactively and,
yes.
And in a healthy, I don't know the right word, but like a healthy way.
That's right.
You know, stuff.
Rabbi, my question is that hedonistic in itself? You know, having leisure time where you can read, learn Torah, talk philosophy, it seems that is enjoying life because
that's right.
But isn't that a little selfish? What if you can make a lot of money working really, really hard and
yeah.
then feed like starving children in Africa or in
Israel? I hear that. But even there, Adrian, if you're making money in order to help those starving children, you're not making money for making money's sake. There's something higher there. Namely to justice of helping people. So everybody, there's going to be a whole spectrum of people depending upon their talents, depending upon their interests. But one thing will be shared. There's going to have to be a balancing of higher wisdom and ideals versus a pure materialism for its own sake. Now, what exactly is going to be the best balance for any given individual? That's going to require some careful thought. But there's going to be certain elements that everyone is going to have. There's going to have to be some tzedakah and taking care of others, some growth and learning for oneself, and that those things in any given individual, how much of one, how much of the other, that's going to be that's going to have to be a personal exploration. All right, everybody, I will I'll leave it at that. I appreciate everybody being here, and I look forward to some other time of meeting everybody again.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Lila Tov, Toda Rabba.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Okay. Robert, bye-bye.
Can I still 5 more minutes of your time?
Of mine? Sure.
Hang on, let me stop the recording.